Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 97.9 The Wren. The wake-up call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. Sunday morning wake-up call here today. Today we're going to take on an interesting topic. We're going to talk about some of the 50th anniversaries throughout U.S. culture being discussed and celebrated this year in 2021. We brought along two guests today, Professor Andrea Presch. She's a UVA professor of media studies and sociology at the University of Virginia. Also served as executive director of the Virginia Film Festival. Prior career faculty positions include departments as diverse as communications, sociology, writing studies, social psychology, film, and women's studies. We have Fiona Greenland. She's a UVA assistant professor of sociology. She studies the construction of cultural heritage and the uses of antiquities in contemporary politics and markets. Ladies, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you. Thanks, Rick, for having us.
Great to be here.
Well, I have been wanting to do something similar to this show for a while. And you regularly see or hear on the news, on the radio, wherever you get your information from about today, back in time, this happened X number of years ago. And if you listen to NPR, their NPR is 50 years old today or this year. So they are doing their own version of this. And it triggered me to go find folks to come on and do Sunday morning wake-up calls version of this program. So, Professor Press, first I want to know what makes an event or a film or a product, an album culturally memorable or even iconic in the first place?
Well, you know, in media studies, we have a concept that we call a media event. And I think in the modern era, and I'm thinking really throughout the 20th century and probably before, if you point to iconic events like the death of President John F. Kennedy, or the first American space, or 9/11, what immediately comes to mind is media coverage of these events and how that galvanized the population. They were media events, the death of Princess Diana and the television coverage of her funeral and the mourning around her. So I would say in the modern era, a memorable event is a media event, but Professor Greenland studies the pre-modern era. She may have different ideas about what makes a cultural event memorable.
Yeah, and I would agree with the focus on media coverage as an important factor in what makes something memorable, because I think that speaks to a collective recognition of a thing or an event, a film, for example, as memorable. And I would add a couple more things. A shared experience. We could think about feelings, maybe like an exciting encounter for the very first time with a particular album or artist, going to a show. And then I would also add cohort take up. So that's an idea we use in sociology to think about how a birth cohort or years of people born in and around the same period of time, recognizing together that they've just been through something unique and distinctive. And I guess a final thought on that is a lot of folks who study iconic milestones and long-term memories of things have suggested that young cohorts or young generations are the most active in creating those iconic milestones. And so there must be something, too, about how when you're a young adult, you're maybe more likely to change your worldview or reflect back on something as having been formative and worth remembering.
Whether we have experienced this together as a cohort group, or whether it is because multiple cohort groups have witnessed it through media coverage, why do we feel the need to witness it over and over again? Because isn't that what's happening when we note it on the calendar and say, Jim Morrison died. This is the death of Jim Morrison happened in 1971. Jim Morrison from the band The Doors. And so for many people, or many media organizations, they will say, you know, when, and I don't have the date in front of me, September 9th, 1971, Jim Morrison passed. And that happens every year, every year. What purpose is there to that in a sociological manner?
It can be in part, I think, that we structure our social lives through the shared reflection on something traumatic in the case of the passing of Jim Morrison. There are also, of course, positive memories or milestones, anniversaries that we also reflect on. And I think that for me, I like to study the ways in which we come to understand or think we've had a direct experience, even in cases where we weren't there or were remote, because in learning from and recognizing other people's experiences, their versions of that milestone, we bond with them. So for sociologists, there's something very important about that group experience and the feeling of being part of something, the carrier group of a memory or milestone that stitches us together with other people.
And Professor Press, so just to go back to the Jim Morrison example, in media studies, in some ways it seems, and not to belittle the what some people would say is the importance of Jim Morrison in music, but in some ways it often seems that material is filler to me. How this day is Penguin Day. This day is, this day is birthday card day. And so today we're honoring or noting Jim Morrison passed on this day. It just happened to this year to be 50 years ago. Your thoughts on that in a media studies kind of way?
Well, yeah, I think you are putting your finger on one of the primary characteristics of the current media environment, that we are bombarded with hours and hours of ubiquitous media coverage. We never get to have silence on our television screens, our radios, on YouTube. So there is sort of a grasping for material that isn't always perhaps the most important material. If every day we have 24 hours to fill on a radio station, that is a lot of work to search for topics to fill the 24 hours. And I know that I'm a true crime enthusiast, and I have just discovered a new podcast that tells me a crime that was committed for every day of the year. It's called Cup of Coffee with Crime. Start your morning knowing about the anniversary of whatever crime was committed today. And it's kind of a watering down, I think, of what is interesting about crime and the prosecution of criminals, because there are too many podcasts and too much fillers needed.
Sunday morning wake-up call talking about anniversaries through U.S. culture. This year, 50th anniversaries throughout U.S. culture. Our guest, Professor Fiona Greenland, UVA's Department of Sociology, and Professor Andrea Press, Sociology Department, as well as a professor in the Media Studies. So let's list a few. Let's pick a genre and list a few and talk about their importance, if they have any, 50 years later, because they're noted. So let's do TV first, if you're both okay with that. Some of the ones that I that I found, 1971, so 50 years later, 50th anniversaries of Masterpiece Theater, Sonny and Cher Comedy Hour, Soul Train, The Electric Company, and Norman Lear's All in the Family. So let's talk about a couple of these. Who wants to take on Masterpiece Theater and The Electric Company? Because weren't both of those on PBS?
They were. And I think you're right to point out that their anniversaries could be celebrated as a move on American television towards the position that it now holds. Media scholars used to belittle television studies, and we really didn't teach television in college classrooms. Scholars didn't write about television very much 50 years ago. But now we actually look to television productions for some of the highest production values of our culture. What we call quality television has surpassed popular filmmaking in many ways as the way some of the most important cultural productions come about. And I would say one way to look at the history of current quality television might be to look at 1971's production of Masterpiece Theater, which was a great media event at the time. All of a sudden, you could learn something from watching television. I remember Upstairs, Downstairs was a very popular early show on Masterpiece Theater, and it taught us about the British class system, what the difference between the upper class and the working class were. Americans didn't often know much about that history. and Electric Company was the beginning of educational television for children. Sesame Street, Electric Company, all of a sudden, Saturday morning TV wasn't a wasteland. It might be looked at as a place where children learn math, they learn how to read, they learn the alphabet, and it started to be seen as with a lot of potential. Oh, maybe we could educate children with this black box that sits in most American living rooms. And it was the beginning of a change in attitudes toward television programming, which I would say today our attitudes have really come 100%. And most media departments have one or more scholars specializing in television studies.
I would love to jump in and add to Andrea's observations about the power of television and it being taken more and more seriously as this social medium. Rick, you mentioned Norman Lear and All in the Family, and we've got to spend a minute talking about that. This show debuted in 1971. Norman Lear, up-and-coming writer, had some successful projects. This show was always bound to stir up controversy because in the Norman Lear fashion, he was taking on vital social issues of the day concerning race, concerning gender relations, concerning class and culture and politics. It's all there. And he did it in front of a live studio audience. So it's hard to imagine right now, I think, given the diversity of television offerings, scripted shows that Andrea touched on, it's hard to imagine how that show would have upended things or kind of shaken the genre of television. But it did, and not everybody liked it, found the characters problematic, controversial, but it then went on, right? It was like a slow burn success. We can look back on it now as a true cultural milestone for changing the way television was done and sort of what television was capable of doing. Yeah, I would leave it at that with All in the Family.
How about a program like Soul Train? I mean, now we're talking about different ethnicities.
They are. And I think, unfortunately, in the 1960s, you have the massive underrepresentation of non-white populations in popular television. And Soul Train is the beginning of noting that and questioning the omission of African-American music and African-American audiences on television. And I think it's taken decades, but we're actually finally coming to terms with the white hegemony in the film industry and the television industry. And I think we're watching some massive social changes before our eyes right now that you could say Soul Train began.
Again, our show today, we're talking about 50th anniversaries throughout U.S. culture, some specifics, some of the importance, and how they're celebrated today. Our guest, Professor Andrea Press, Professor Fiona Greenland from University of Virginia. Take our break. We'll be right back. And here we are, Sunday morning wake-up call, talking about all the things that you find special in your life or that you're shaking your head going, what in the world are they talking about? And you should stay, listen for the hour, because we're going to get to something that you love. Because, professors, one of the things that I have found to be something I just don't understand, but it happens for every generation, right? Is that there are things that happened that are new in your generation, and then there are things that the new generation finds cool that actually happened like two generations before. So some of the music that we may get to, or some of the cultural events that we hope to talk about. The folks who are now 15 or 20 are going, oh, that's awesome. While the group in between is probably going, that's ridiculous. Why does that happen? Professor Press, can you start?
Well, you know, I guess when you talk about that phenomenon, what comes to my mind is the music of the Beatles. Because I think Beatles music is very popular with young people now. And I know my children really enjoy it. And I think there is something to the notion that some culture is simply very high quality, very good. So you also see that with amazing films that might be 50 years old, they might be 100 years old. But when young people discover them, they love them because they are excellent, high-quality films. So I would argue Beatles music is going to be listened to 100 years from now because a lot of it was a really great music. And I would say that if you look at really high quality films in the heritage of American film history, and I'm trying to think of what I would use as an example of that, because some of them are very politically problematic. I teach a class in the films of Alfred Hitchcock, and his personal life was lived with some instances of harassing some of his employees sexually, unfortunately. But when we rediscover his films, we see some brilliance in the films that he produced, and they're part of his American films, at least, are part of the American film heritage. And so I really love introducing his best films to my students. Mostly they haven't seen them. And they really recognize the quality in those products right away because it's evident.
I think music is a great place to explore that. And the Beatles is a terrific example of a positive, like, generational rediscovery. And that is great news for me because I'm also a Beatles fan, and I really want young people to continue listening to their music and thinking about what the Beatles kind of did to change popular music. I mean, what a cultural phenomenon in it. And, you know, here we are about 50 years after the band's breakup. So I'm sure that that's like a key experience that we can all reflect on. But what I also wanted to say was, you know, there are other things that I just can't get my head around. So an example would be Charles Manson. And the college students I'm teaching right now know who Manson is and are actually fascinated. So there have been biopics and TV series that sort of like reconstruct the Manson cult. There's been a movie, at least one in the last year or so. So that's one where I think there must be something else going on with why and how young people look back and find someone or something cool or interesting. Andrea, I bet you've got more to say on that one too.
On Manson, well, I think Manson, he's perhaps popular now because there is a little bit of a craze around stories of criminals, the true crime phenomenon, the elevation of serial killers to cultural phenomena. And he, even though I don't think he actually killed anyone himself, he seems to have masterminded quite a few murders. And for me, he's also very iconic because his hippie philosophy, the commune that his followers and himself, they lived on, symbolizes kind of the seamy underside of 60s culture and its demise, unfortunately, where, of course, he represents a lot of really negative values. He was quite a criminal and a dangerous murderer, and at the same time identified as a hippie and an advocate of free love and communal living and stealing from the rich to help the poor. So he's a complex cultural figure and obviously had been a very charismatic personality to amass a series of followers.
When you have someone like Charles Manson, who's, I believe it's his conviction that it was 50 years ago. I believe the conviction of Manson was 1971. When you have someone like Charles Manson, do you have a negative feedback from a large percentage of the community, from the United States community as a whole, when... and celebrate is not the word, but when the mention in sort of a popular manner comes out that, you know, on the news, it's 50 years ago today that Charles Manson conviction was, as opposed to just letting it go. That was an evil thing to most people, and just forget it and put it away. It's not just the death of a rock star or the breakup of a band or the release of a TV show. But here we are talking about it on, and not us, but if NPR or the newspaper or whomever mentions it as though this is worth remembering, do you get negative blowback on that?
Well, you know, I think you bring up a really important point about the media, which is that coverage of criminals and someone as evil as Charles Manson, or as evil as Adolf Hitler, for that matter, increases their fame and their renown, and in some cases spurs young people to follow them. So you see kind of Nazi symbolism and Nazi paraphernalia among young people in the new right. We saw some of that in the march on Charlottesville by white supremacists carrying Nazi-connected symbols. And the media may be contributing to that with the kind of extensive coverage that they offer of these figures, and part of why they offer it is people want to read about them. It makes their shows popular and increases their audience, and that, unfortunately, is a motivation in American media, which is commercial. We're seeking a large audience for our products, and not every national media is commercial. Some is state-run, and so they don't have to worry as much about seeking a large audience.
Again, Professor Andrea Prest, Professor Fiona Greenland here today, Sunday morning wake-up call, as we talk about anniversaries throughout U.S. culture, and we're today speaking specifically about 50th anniversaries. We started off talking about the Beatles breakup and why it was significant, and music. I looked back to see some of the albums the music that was released in 1971. And it appears to be just this crazy special year. Although I guaranteed I didn't look for a number of years. But John Lennon's Imagine, Marvin Gaye's What's Going On, Led Zeppelin IV, Rolling Stones' Sticky Fingers, Joni Mitchell, Blue, Carole King's Tapestry, Janis Joplin's Pearl, Rod Stewart's Every Picture Tells a Story, Elton John's Madman Across the Water, The Doors' L.A. Woman. They were all released in 1971. As mentioned, it was the death of Jim Morrison that year. The Eagles started that year. It was the concert for Bangladesh was that year. It's like 1971 was this this biorhythmic piece where everything came together in a pinnacle.
Well, you know, I would like to speak to that because as a baby boomer, perhaps I am biased, but I have to say that the cultural movements of the 60s, which gave rise to the tradition of rock and roll that I think almost everyone you talked about could be placed in one way or another, they're all iconic of 60s music. Janis Joplin, Carole King, John Lennon. It was an incredibly vibrant and generative cultural environment that allowed talent to flourish. I mean, I really think every one of those artists that you mentioned was an incredibly talented artist, and those albums deserve to be remembered because they have greatness in them. My brother is a rock and roll musician, and his kids are in their 20s and 30s, and he always says, our music was better and young people know it. That's why they listen to it. And, you know, it's a cliche because every generation advocates for their own music, and it's very special when you grow up with a tradition of music. But 60s music generated just dozens of brilliant artists, and that was a great moment for popular music.
Well, and I listed those specifically because I believe I can't count quick enough without being too distracted. There's like 8 or 10 of those. And I believe that you would find all of those in some sort of in the top 40 of the top 100 listing of all time. And they all came out of
Rolling Stones, right?
Right. Some sort of thing. Right. Obviously we're not bringing out, classical music. We're not separating. We're not trying to compile every musical genre together, not including jazz or something. But I think if you took made a top 100 list, those are all somewhere in the top hefty top percentage, yet they all came out of one year out of the last 70 years now. And I just found that to be fascinating.
I think it's important to also point out that we were in a different, the music industry, the financing of music was entirely different in 1971. So those were all albums produced for a mass audience, not a niche audience, which is much more what we have in the music spectrum right now. So they would have been consumed by more audience members. But there is a sort of a bias towards white musicians, toward male musicians, toward heterosexual-based lyrics, that the era we're in now of niche audiences begins to address. So we have more diversity of music now. So we can say these were the greatest albums of all time, and that in part is based on the number of albums that were sold because they were marketed to a mass audience that in a lot of ways no longer exists now. So the albums of today are not really in running for the greatest albums of all time. So we haven't quite adapted to the new musical environment. We don't know how to rank music now because we don't have the same terms available to us.
Sunday morning wake-up call, as we talk about 50th anniversaries of various events and music, and we're going to get to film and some cultural iconic items throughout U.S. culture. Let's take our break. We'll be right back. Sunday morning wake-up call. Having some fun talking about 50th anniversaries. Professor Fiona Greenland with us today, UVA's Department of Sociology, and Professor Andrea Press, UVA's Department of Media Studies, as well as the Sociology Department. So, Professor Greenland, there was mention of being a baby boomer. Can you talk about generations in general? How do sociologists study and think about various generations?
It's a great question. Big picture, sociologists would make a distinction between a birth cohort and a generation, and would say birth cohort has to do with population spacing. And baby boomer is probably the classic example. And yet a birth cohort is no guarantee of a generation. Generation we can think of as culturally linked. So all of the things we've been discussing, shared experiences, a memorable person or event, a musical breakthrough, a filmic breakthrough, those are the sorts of things that can create generation effects. And we think, too, that the culture that kind of ties together a generation features some things like distinctiveness, breakthroughs, experiences that resonate with, like, feelings, like sensations, whether pleasurable or negative. And then maybe most fundamentally that the generation identifies itself through that cultural space. So I would start off by just acknowledging that distinction between cohort and generation, and how we think about it is like the generation is a cohort plus culture. I would also add parenthetically that most sociologists I know would agree that baby boomer is a real thing, that there is the cohort plus the shared cultural experiences. But they're a little less sold on some of the other labels, such as Gen X, millennials, and now we have Gen Z. Some would say those are marketing devices, and we're still waiting to see what, for example, Gen Z will point to as its cultural icons or memories.
So you say, or if I heard this correctly, that a birth cohort is not necessarily a generation, or doesn't, or there could be multiple birth cohorts in a generation?
I think a good way to think about it is every one of us has a birth cohort, whether we like it or not, just by dint of being born in a particular year. And yet generation comes from experiencing and identifying with things that resonate across our birth cohort. So the birth cohort is sort of automatic, and the generation of the identification through culture comes from our participation in it.
Because, you look at the defining years of the baby boomers, which you said had been identified as an actual generation. And baby boomers are listed as 1946 to 1964. So 18 years. But if you ask someone born in 1964, if they are of the same, if they experienced, their life experience was the same as someone born in 1946, they would say no.
Well, yeah, I think with the baby boomers, we are talking about sort of a sprawling number of years. That's the way they're defined. And in some ways, they're defined by the economic situation in the U.S. more than the culture that each of those people you mentioned would identify with. So there's the years of American prosperity post-World War II that are usually identified beginning 1946 and ending with the assassination of JFK. And so that's roughly coterminous with the baby boomer years, and those years were years of massive cultural generativity and cultural change and new genres of film and television and music arising, that parts of that birth cohort really strongly identified with. Not everybody, certainly, but certainly parts of the birth cohort identified with all of that culture. And it's a varied culture, because the culture, popular music in 1946 looked pretty different than popular music in 1963. You know, and I'm not sure that we would talk about it as even the same kind of music, but the phenomenon of popular music that young people started to purchase is a baby boomer phenomenon, because young people were not identified as a market before those years. They generally didn't have disposable income. And that really just began in those years of post-war American prosperity. So you could have youth music, and you could have films that were designated as teen films aimed at a young market. And later you could have youth television shows that were aimed at young people.
All right. Again, Professor Andrea Press with us today, as well as Professor Fiona Greenland, as we talk about generations and anniversaries throughout U.S. culture, highlighting the 50th anniversaries that we're celebrating or noting in 2021. Here's some interesting foods that came about in 1971. McDonald's Quarter Pounder, Count Chocula, and the Frankenberry cereals, as well as Cocoa Pebbles and Fruity Pebbles cereals, and Hamburger Helper. Professor Greenland, can you comment on were there anything that tie those together, and then being 50 years old this year?
Man, I can just like riff on Hamburger Helper all day long. I want to make sure I'm not the only one on this call who's enjoyed the pleasures of Hamburger Helper and Tuna Helper and associated products. We probably all remember the little talking glove hopping around in the counter, helping out at dinner time. Yeah, I mean, a thread for me there is prepared foods, both as convenient for a household with two working parents. Great way to get a hot dinner on the table with minimum fuss. And the idea that these prepared foods were nutritious, maybe even more nutritious than raw foods. And that's a bit of a counterintuitive thought today when there's been a big turn away from processed foods and towards eating or preparing our own meals from scratch. But at the time, fortification, like fortifying breakfast cereals with vitamins, that was really important. And you wanted to like dress up the vitamins with cartoon characters and sugar so that kids would have them. The idea that like a single bowl of Count Chocula gives kids everything they need to be healthy and is a lot of fun. So I think about my childhood having those prepared foods be pretty much an everyday occurrence in the household menu, and how it really was liberating for my folks to have something that could be nutritious and prepared right away. And then those were some of the first things that I prepared. So I think that, you know, across the United States, 1971 is like part of this moment when, especially for working women, prepared foods are like a godsend, a way to like be efficient in the workplace and at home.
How about some of the other cultural markings? Walt Disney World came about in 1971. Starbucks, the Nike swoosh logo, FedEx, Professor Press.
FedEx. That's interesting.
Yeah, they're not anybody's highlight at the moment.
Well, you know, not on my calendar. Point to Starbucks. I think Starbucks is an interesting phenomenon, as is McDonald's. I don't want to leave without mentioning McDonald's. I do remember the first time I went to a fast food restaurant because I was in high school. And it was a separate space that had not existed before for young people to congregate and get together, a little bit like the beginning of enclosed shopping malls, which also began right around the same time. I was fortunate to grow up in New Jersey, which is the shopping mall capital of the earth. And I believe the first enclosed mall was built right around 1970s or early 70s in New Jersey. It is, as Professor Greenland says, so related to women entering the workplace in the wake of second wave feminism and needing more easily prepared foods, but also the idea that quick foods that were packaged might actually be more healthy. It was more modern. It was something my grandmother never used. And modern life was identified with being more sanitary and more healthy. Starbucks, I think, is a fascinating economic phenomenon, commercial phenomenon. I remember when my mother moved to South Florida, Starbucks struggling to get a foothold in South Florida because the retirees in her neighborhood really needed to be convinced that they had to spend $6 or $5 for a cup of coffee because they were used to much cheaper cups of coffee than Starbucks was offering. And I remember my mother saying, take me to get a latte. Everyone talks about having a latte, and I don't know what it is. And she had to be introduced to a much higher priced cup of coffee with a fancy French name that she didn't understand. And she was having none of it. She thought it was a lot of hype about nothing. But 5 years later, there were Starbucks in every corner in that neighborhood. People were susceptible to the commercial pitches of that company, and it's made millions of dollars for some people. It also spawns, again, a different social space, the coffee house, where people can congregate and read and work and meet and discuss issues. And it does have its positive side. In sociological theory, we often talk about the history of the coffee house, which begins in the 19th century as a place where newspapers, which most people couldn't afford and most people couldn't read, were read out loud to groups of people who wanted to know what was in them.
Yeah, Starbucks is... Starbucks is a great example of a cultural phenomenon that links several generations. It, this concept of the third place. So we've got our home and we've got our work and then the Starbucks cafe, yet a third place. And maybe we are socializing with friends, or maybe we're having a cup of coffee on our own, working on something, but a more relaxed environment. And the idea that, right, you're paying money for a cup of coffee, but also effectively renting a table to sit and work. So, you know, I'm kind of like amazed by the enduring effects of Starbucks cafe culture, the third place, and how that has had tremendous effects from everything from the consumption of coffee itself, what we think of it and how it's prepared, to the notion that there are these private spaces within the public, like you can be sitting at a table and feel like it's your space. And then also the ways in which they people socialize and start friendships, sometimes randomly in cafes, things that like wouldn't quite work in other kinds of social spaces, but that make sense in cafe culture.
Ladies, let's we got about 5 minutes left. I want to make sure we at least toss in a few movies here. So 1971, A Clockwork Orange, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, Dirty Harry, Fiddler on the Roof, Harold and Maude, Shaft. But two key things here. THX 1138, which is a start to Lucasfilms, and Duel, which was the debut of Steven Spielberg. And I think most people are aware of George Lucas and Steven Spielberg today, and they both sort of debuted in 1971.
Okay. Well, I would say, let's see. In 1967, you have Warren Beatty producing and I believe directing Bonnie and Clyde, which changes the face of American cinema. It becomes, it leaves the Hollywood studio era, which is experiencing its demise in the early 60s and losing great shares of audience to that new black box television. And it introduces something entirely different that broadcast television cannot duplicate, which is extreme violence, extreme gore, and extreme sex on the screen. And we really haven't seen that in American film before 1967. We've seen a little with Hitchcock's Psycho in 1960, which is paves the way for the kind of violence you see in Bonnie and Clyde. But that is a pathbreaker. So most of the films you're talking about are part of the new Hollywood. In 1972, we have The Godfather, Coppola's The Godfather, and in 1975, we have Spielberg's Jaws. Now, these are both media events. They have enormous audiences, lines went around the block to see The Godfather, to see Jaws. They played for years in theaters. And it was the beginning of what we call the blockbuster era in film. What you wanted to do, instead of producing 500 films a year, which is what Hollywood produced at the height of the studio system, you wanted to produce way fewer films that cost way more money and offered way more special effects, which, again, the television screen could not duplicate, and brought in a mass audience and made enormous amounts of money. And the new Hollywood paved the way for sex and violence, and Jaws paved the way for special effects. And that was the beginning of what some of us see as a massive transformation in Hollywood cinema. So we do remember a lot of these films because they were media events that drew a mass audience. And you mentioned Willy Wonka. The other mass audience for film would be children's films, because going to the movies would be a special event for a child. So Hollywood was searching to keep its financial head above water in the era of television, because we're in the golden age of television now, in the 60s and 70s with Norman Lear, and we have a lot of competition. Hollywood is trying to keep its head above water, and it discovers the special effects blockbuster, and Spielberg and Lucas are the masters of that. And I think we're in that era to this day with our superhero films and our focus on spectacle, and less of a focus, I think, unfortunately, on writing and dramatic material.
Our guests today, Professor Fiona Greenland, Professor Andrea Press. We were talking about anniversaries and important events throughout U.S. culture, and specifically highlighting a few of the 50th. We didn't even touch on the 26th Amendment, allowing you to vote at age 18, Swan v. Charlotte, which was an end to busing. Cigarette ads were banned from TV. Amtrak and NASDAQ came about in 1971. There's a lot going on, folks, in 1971. Sometimes you just got to pay attention. Ladies, thank you so much for being with us today. I appreciate your time.
Thanks, Rick.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's
been fun.
All right, everybody. Talk to you next week.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on Real Oldies 97.9 The Wren. The Wake-Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at cvillepodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for The Wake-Up Call, only on 97.9 The Wren.